Hi, this is David Russell. Welcome to episode 48 of the No Bad Bosses podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Dave's Charm School, the only soft skills training for people who want to have well-behaved employees. I mean, hey, people don't show up and have all the soft skills down. Some people have anger issues. Some people are disrespectful and don't realize it. Tone of voice, time management issues. We address these things in Dave's Charm School. It's online. It has exams, pre-recorded lessons. It's low cost. Why not try it for free for 2 weeks? Go to davescharmschool.com. No apostrophe in the Daves, just D-A-V-E-S, charmschool.com. Try it for 14 days free. You can't lose. My guest today is Charlie Hedges, and he has retired but works a lot of hours in Wells for Life, wellsoflife.org. Where for $6,000, you can put in a well in a distant country and help 1,000 people live. That's an awesome thing. But he's got some leadership tips. I mean, he has been a coach with CEOs of billion-dollar corporations. I think you'll enjoy the show. Here we go. Okay, that was good timing because now we're live. So, hi, everyone. We're live with Charlie Hedges, and he's, you know, Charlie, your background is so varied. You said you've got like five or six careers. Why don't you let people know, you know, where your experience comes from, and then let's talk about where you're at today.
Well, you know what I was thinking, David, is that, and by the way, Lee, thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah. Let me tell you what I ended up doing and how I started. So I finished my, I've been retired for 3 years, and we'll get into that because I'm not really retired. I'm working for a nonprofit that keeps me busy 20 to 25 hours a week. But I ended my career as a, as an executive coach. And for the last 5 years of my career, I coached primarily CEOs and their E-level reports. So yeah. I was doing, and it was just, I just had, at the end, I really had four primary clients, and they were all billion-dollar companies. So I was the executive coach to the CEO. And as you know, who does the CEO have to talk to? You know, he can't tell his problems to the board, and he can't tell his problems to his direct report. So he's got a guy that, you know, we'd meet monthly, and I'd be the dumpy, and we'd come together with strategies.
And so you'd meet once a month. How long would you meet for in those meetings?
Oh, they would vary. Typically, it would be about a half a day, but I would see them more frequently than that. Sometimes more frequently, sometimes less, depending on the need, because it would end up that I would not only coach, I would always get into leadership development, and I would then be working with their HR people and developing strategic programs. But I think what's interesting, what you were talking about, that I've had several different careers. I'm a person that grows bored quickly. Not real quickly, you know, I get that 7 to 10 year itch, and then it's time to move. But my career, I think I was really fortunate, and my career started when I was 15 years old. And when I was 15 years old, I lied about my age. I had to say I was 16 in order to get this job, because you have to be 16. And I got there, and this was in 1965. So this is going back a ways.
Just a few years.
What's that?
Just a few years.
Yeah, but some of the memories are like they were yesterday. And, you know, it was that I was different. It was different in those days. You know, I wasn't flipping burgers or making shakes. You know, I was working at a chemical company where all men worked. And it was guys that were 30 to 50 years old. And I was the kid, because I, you know, had some contact with somebody and who knew the president, and they hired me. And I'll never forget one job. that I had that was just so fun to tell you how there was no such thing as OSHA in 1965. And so we made a chemical called sulfuric nitric sulfide. Anyway, it was sulfuric acid and another chemical compound. And it was in a tank about 6 feet high, 3 feet wide, and 6 feet long. No, it was maybe 5 feet high. But then I would the motor froze, and it was no longer agitating the sulfuric acid and the other chemical. And so they needed somebody to come in, and it was a slush. It was just big green slush, and they needed to dig it out. It had to get out. So somebody had to get in it. And so who did they pick but the 15-year-old kid? And the sulfuric acid generates so much heat that I would wear these, you know, the tall rubber boots, and we would have to fill the boots with water so I could go stand inside before the boots got too hot again. And I came out of that thing, and my mom washed my clothes that night, and everything fell apart because it was all sulfuric acid. I had sulfuric acid scars on my arm. So I learned what work was about early.
Yeah, it sounds like you're lucky to be alive from that one.
Well, I think half the people that work there are lucky to be alive. Yeah, that was back in the day. But you know what I think was important about that experience? Is that gave me that, along with loading trucks and a couple of other jobs like that, you know, while I was going through college and yeah. Having an opportunity to work a working man's lifestyle, I really became familiar with blue collar workers. And so I'm just as comfortable with a blue collar worker as I am with the CEO of a billion-dollar company. And I can sit down and have a conversation with each and in each other's language because they speak two different languages and I'm not talking Spanish and English.
Yeah.
But it really gave me a lot of experience to work with people of different backgrounds.
So what were your other careers? What else did you get involved in?
Okay. Next, I was the director of the wet processing department of a carpet mill. So that means whatever was application of color. And we did about 3 million square feet of carpet a month. And I was in charge of about 120 employees. And I was still, at that time, I was maybe around 25, 26. I did that job for exactly 10 years. And then I became invested in faith. And
if I can, Charlie, I'm kind of curious. So you have 120 employees and you're in charge of color at a carpet manufacturing plant?
The application of color.
The application of color. So like, what is what's like the funniest memory you have from back then, or the biggest lesson you learned from that experience? I mean, there must have been some unique situations that came up with that many people in that type of environment.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was kind of I feel like that time was kind of a blur, you know.
Yeah.
It was in the 70s and I was more interested in being a 70s out there player than I was in my career. It just so happened to be that I was good at what I did, and I got to keep my job doing that. But I did most of my time playing hard and working because I had to.
Okay. All right. And then you went into this faith opportunity?
No, I'm sorry, a faith opportunity. No, that okay. was, I did an entire career switch. I went from working in business to becoming a minister of a church with 12,000 people. Now, I wasn't the head minister, but I was one of the ministers.
And where was that?
That was in Irvine, California. It was called at the time, it was South Coast Community Church. I went to seminary for 3 years and studied Greek and Hebrew. And then I came and I was a pastor for about 7 years and realized I was not hardwired to be a pastor because what I thought was my job description was not my job description.
And where was the difference there as far as what you thought versus what it was?
Yeah, that was a surprise. I thought I was going into Mary and Barry. You know, I thought...
What do you mean Mary and Barry?
That's what ministers do.
Oh, that's right. Marry people and then bury them when they die. Yeah, that's right.
Bury people, baptize people, preach, counsel, you know, do all of the ministry kind of work. And it turned out that ministry was about 15% of my job and administration was about 85% of my job.
Oh, ugh.
And so I did that for about 7 years. And I said, shoot, if I'm going to be an admin guy, I might as well get paid to do it. And I made a career change. And I just got this phone call out of the blue from Chevron, asked if they were looking for external consultants. They're looking for external trainers that they wanted to come in and train for team building programs. And I decided to do that, and I made as much in a three-day program. I made as much as I did in a month as a minister. And I said, I think this is the way I want to go.
So, where did you get your material for your team training stuff?
There was one thing I did was the Covey. Remember the Seven Habits?
Yeah.
Seven Habits of High-Performing People. I did that, the Covey Seven Habits, and it was before Covey had videos where it would be Covey doing the material and then a facilitator would walk people through questions. I actually presented the material. It was pre the video, so I presented the material there. Then I learned a team-building program that's about accountability-driven teams, and we would facilitate team sessions where we help create a mission, vision, critical success factors, all the, you know, behavioral standards, accountability standards. And that I learned from a group called Impact. And then I learned two meetings and facilitative leadership courses from a group called Interaction Associates. So I would just go out. I became the go-to trainer for Chevron on that and would just be on the field training people. But you know what came out of it that was really cool was they liked the way I trained so much. They said, would you join our group on presenting our new environmental policy? Chevron was one of the first oil companies to do this was a post-Valdez deal where oil companies really got serious into environment. And they had an expert from the East Coast who used to be in charge of the DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection for the state of New Jersey. He would present all the content. I would come in and do the facilitative stuff of getting people talk and work together. Doing those sorts of actions. But what happened, they decided they wanted to take it internationally. And the guy that was in charge didn't want to go international. So they asked me to just run the whole program. And they asked me to explain all of the basics, all of the technical laws of environmental protection and what Chevron's environmental protection. I have no history in environment. I know nothing about this. But I had listened to the lectures enough where I had each lecture down and I had the material down and I ended up doing it in, oh my goodness, like seven different countries. I would go around, and I even went to Aberdeen and helped them. This is funny, and helped them. I facilitated and gave them advice and helped them writing an environmental policy.
Well, it shows if you use the material enough, it becomes ingrained in you. So where did you go from there?
Okay, from there, as I was doing my training in the States, people started asking me, do you do what you talk about? You know, you're talking about facilitating sessions and doing group work and all, and, you know, you're training us how to do it. Do you actually do that stuff? And I said, of course, you know, never having done it before. But, you know, the answer to a consultant, when you ask a consultant, do you do it? Your first answer is always yes. And then you go right to the research and find out what it's all about. And I said, yes. And the next thing I knew is I was facilitating high-level meetings for executive sessions in and out of Chevron. Some of it had to do with Chevron, and some of it had to do with some other companies that a guy from Chevron was included with. I even went to Saudi Arabia. I went to one of my most challenging facilitating activities was, I was asked to go to Saudi Arabia to help facilitate two teams who were doing a $3.5 billion upgrade on a refinery. And there was the Saudi team and there was the U.S. team, and they hated each other and they couldn't get anything together. And they wanted me to do, they paid me for a full week to come in and run a 6-hour meeting. And they're flying people in from all over the world. And I've got 6 hours to try to resolve conflict and get these people working together.
So how did you do that between the two different cultures?
Well, the Saudi people, you know, most of them were educated in the United States. And so there's not a language barrier, but there are hidden cultural aspects in the in the Arabic culture that I would have to be aware of. And there was tribalism that I didn't even know about. And so some people, you know, secretly would be involved with one sect and not another, in another sect, not necessarily religious, but mostly it was just these two groups didn't like each other. You know, the Americans were looked at as spies coming in.
So how did you overcome that? How did you get them to work together?
You know,
you only had David, 6 hours, right?
I had 6 hours. Yeah. It was made clear we had to focus, but I'm very comfortable with conflict. I don't necessarily like conflict in my own life, but I am I'm not bothered by conflict. When I'm with two groups that are really at each other, it doesn't get to me internally. I can just see, you know, the depth of it, what's causing this. And so I have a process that I would take people through. That where one group says, this is what we want to happen. The other group makes the list. I break them up and makes a flip chart. This is what we want to see happen. And just to make this brief, I put them together and then we agree. Can you do this? Can you do that? And we agree on one final agreement, what it's going to take to make these people work together. And it never fails. It just works where people come out and they say, I mean, that's all we have to do? Now, the problem with things like that is that people always end up saying they're going to work together, but unless there's follow-up on it, you know, the conflict continues.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with this one, unfortunately, there was no follow-up.
Yeah. Well, that's what I suspect. So, Where did you go after that?
That was when I started getting into executive coaching. I became an executive coach before anyone knew what an executive coach was. It was 1994 or 1995. And I used to tell people, ask me, what do I do? And I say, I'm a coach. And they'd say, of what team? And I would say, no, I'm a coach of a, I coach, I do business coaching. What is business coaching? And I had to explain people. As a matter of fact, I got into coaching so early that 360s were just, they were talked about, they were bantered about. You know, the 360 feedback is something that people really ought to use. So I had to develop my own 360.
And did you do that as a paper version or did you have it as a software product?
Oh, it was pre-software. That was a paper version, and I had an incredible executive assistant who would put everything together on Excel, and we'd pass out, you know, really great. It was great 360. You know, it was done archaically, but it was really effective.
Yeah. So what are some of the things when you think back about your time coaching these executives, some of them, you know, CEOs of billion-dollar corporations, what are some of the situations, stories, whatever, that come to mind that, you know, might help our audience learn something?
Well, you know, I can, I had a humorous situation that I still laugh at today, and that I was working with the CEO who would give lectures, and I was also, it sounds crazy all the things I do, but I gave a lot of speeches, and I was pretty good at delivering speeches. So I would be his speech coach as well. When he would do speeches, I would go in and he would show me his outline before, and I would kind of mess with his outline and work on his outline. And then he'd go and deliver the speech and then ask me, Charlie, you know, what did I do well? And just honing in, he was a good public speaker and he just wanted to be a better public speaker. And I'll never forget, I didn't like the way he ended his speech. So I told him, Mark, your speech was terrific. Everything was great except your clothes. And he says, my clothes? And I said, yeah, you know, we really could work on your clothes. And he says, because he's a really well-dressed man. And he's saying, and he said, I, you know, what are we going to do, go shopping? I said, no, not your attire, the way you close your speech, the end of your speech. We have to work on that and make that stronger.
The joys of the English language.
Yeah, that was fun. I really enjoyed it because once I got to work with the executives and I with the CEO, and then I get to work with the other executives, I really got to have, I felt an impact on culture, an impact on, I developed a really good leadership development program that was adopted by three companies. And I also developed another program, a program developer. I come up with these ideas for performance acceleration where that was purchased by a multi-billion dollar company. And it's a program that helped people. It cuts in half the amount of time that it takes to bring a person up to speed.
Well, how does it do that? I mean, I work with companies on onboarding.
Right.
How do you get it so it cuts the time in half versus whatever they might do?
The research shows that it will take 6 months before a new manager will break even. You know, he loses value for the first 3 months. Adds value for the second 3 months. And then at 6 months, this person or man or woman has developed her skills at that point. I said I could take that to 3 months. And what I did is it's really an interactive program to get the person up to speed with the culture, And with job description, with the people that she may be working with, and outside clients, you know, external people. So we would put all of that together, and there would just be a questionnaire that they would go through, and they would, but they were responsible to take and go to different people and ask these questions and get this all together, gather all the information, go to her direct report, or go to her boss, and then they would go over that and work through it. And they just got information that normally takes 6 months to find out. They would find out in 2 weeks. I mean, it takes six, you know, we may say these are what our values are at the company, but when you talk to people real life, they're going to tell you what the real values are. They're going to tell you what the real roadblocks are, where you know, what it really takes to be successful.
Yeah, but wouldn't you want in those organizations that those values that they've got, they're being reinforced? That were they different every time? I mean, I like yourself, I go in and help companies develop mission, vision, values. And we don't want it like Enron, where, you know, it's a bronze plaque on the wall, but they're doing whatever they want. So are you saying that most of the time you really had to circumvent that, where you had to help them understand, you know, this is what we say is our values, but we really actually have something different?
Well, remember now, when I did this, it was in the late 90s and early 2000s. And it was really before culture was taken seriously.
Okay.
And so people would have mission, vision, values, but never really lived up to any of them. They were just nice plaques on the wall.
Wow, and what a drag.
Yeah, well, that was really common. And then even in cultures, except for your, you know, your really high performing companies that are high value centered, there are values. There are ways, let's don't call them values. There are ways of doing business. There are, let me tell you, here's a story. I work for a company, and it was a Japanese company, and we'll call it Mitsu. That wasn't the name of the company. But they called it the Mitsu way. And everybody knew the Mitsu way. So you did things in Mitsu way. And so as a new consultant, you know, I went to several people and I say, can you tell me what the Mitsu way is? And they said, no, I can tell you what it isn't, but I can't tell you what it is. I can tell you the things we can't do, but I can't tell you what we can do. They didn't have a positive aspect for it.
Wow.
So that was not uncommon, especially in a multinational company, a company run by Japanese, high-level Japanese and all-American workers.
Well, yeah, and all-American workers. Okay. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense with the culture clash and everything. So tell me what you're doing today with this nonprofit and why you decided to get passionate about that and the issues that you see there or that you work through there that are the most challenging, whether it's with volunteers or leaders or donors or whatever it might be, or boards?
You know, that has become one of the most fascinating things. I feel like my work with this nonprofit, I have been trained my whole life to do this work. It was a year ago March. I had a man on my podcast. I also have a podcast. And I had a man on my podcast, and he was representing a company called Wells of Life, and he was the founder director of this NGO nonprofit that digs water wells in Uganda, in rural, very rural areas of Uganda. I mean, really, the road, I mean, trying to get there is almost impossible with four-wheel drive. We're so far back in the boonies. And so I was very impressed with what he did. And they will drill a well, and for $6,000, they will drill a well that will give clean water to 1,000 people for 25 years.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. And one in five children will die from poor water access before the age of five. 20% wow. of children, the infant mortality rate due to water alone.
Wow.
So we're saving the lives of them. So anyway, so I said, this is a cool thing. So we purchased we donated and did a few wells. And then he asked us to, asked me to go to Uganda with him one time. So last August, I went to Uganda and I was ruined. I was that the people are so wonderful. The people are so delightful. And you're talking the poorest of the poor. I mean, there is no such thing as running water, electricity, gas. They had dirt floors. And yet these kids in raggedy clothes, I mean, just clothes, literally raggedy with holes ripped in them. And these kids were just so happy. And then when we would build a well, bring a well there, oh my goodness, the celebration was just amazing. So we now do 100 wells a year.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's tremendous. So 100 wells a year, you're helping 100,000 people a year. It's a big uptick for their lives. So I'm curious, you know, you say you were basically trained your entire career for this job. In what way? So, I mean, what are the challenges you run into with people that you have the skill set where you can help them? I mean, maybe you got some, for instances, some stories, whatever. But why do you believe that you were trained for it?
And I've taken on a new program that is called WASH, which is water sanitation and hygiene. And I am now responsible for helping them have hand washing stations, building latrines, keeping the water area clean and all the contamination. So we are even saving more lives as a result of this. And I just feel like it's the crowning ending of it's my final work chapter, is the way I look at this, is that I'm so dedicated to this company. But you ask about what are the difficulties and issues.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, working with a nonprofit is, first of all, that's a whole different kind of business. But also, we're in a transition that is really interesting, David. This is where it's like any small business, where a founder, director, an entrepreneur starts a business and they grow the business and all of a sudden it starts to become a real business. And, you know, they're bringing in enough money. They have to start hiring employees. And the paradigm that got them to success, that was the influence of the executive director of the founder, gets to where that job has to lessen and this person has to no longer be hands-on in every aspect of the business and has to pass off. And that's a difficult transition. So that's...
Yeah. Otherwise, she's a bottleneck. It can't scale.
Exactly. It can't scale until you make the change. That's exactly right. So that's what I get to do. I get to work with putting in clean water in Uganda, and I get to work with OD with the internal politics of the company.
Interesting. So I'm kind of curious, with your career, the different things you've done, and then you worked with these big CEOs, now you're doing a nonprofit. If you had to boil it down, what are the key things that you would advise someone who wanted to be a better leader?
That's a great question. What are the key things? So I think, you know, I think what you're involved in and what you bring, I think culture is really important. I think that there needs to be a culture of, especially in this new work environment, a culture of being extraordinarily collaborative. The top-down chain of command model really doesn't work. it really works better when there is a collaborative operation going on. You're empowering your employees to do better work. I think that's one of the key. That's one of the keys. Okay. Another I would say is clear roles and responsibilities. And I know that sounds so rudimentary and so obvious, but I go into so many places, and I used to go into so many places, and I even did it this nonprofit where people really weren't sure what their responsibility was.
Yeah. So yeah, no, I agree. It's amazing. And it really affects the person, because it's very difficult to be effective if you're not sure exactly what metrics you're striving to achieve and where you have authority versus responsibility.
Yes, exactly. And it's also a feeling of that I am, when an employee is empowered, an employee becomes invested, and they're invested in their work. And so there's happiness on both sides of the table. There's happiness on the management side of the table, and there's happiness on the employee side of the table. And the employee is much more, as I said, invested, and actually will do much better work and enjoy doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they'll be much more proactive. So
exactly.
So oftentimes, you know, someone who's fully invested is thinking of things that the boss wouldn't think of, or somebody else wouldn't think of, because they're really trying to drive it. Charlie, did I lose your audio?
Spot in the show right now.
Oh, there you are. You're back.
Okay. All right.
So Jeff can cut that, and then
sure.
We're good. So you're back. So anyway, Charlie, you know, I really appreciate you coming on with us today. And what is the URL for the water organization you're part of?
Wellsoflife.org.
Wellsoflife.org. Okay. Well, you know, I encourage our audience to check that out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's really an incredible organization doing incredible work. We have 350 wells now, and as we're growing, and now we're growing at a rate of 100 wells a year. So that means 350,000 people with water.
Yeah.
That didn't have water before.
No, that's incredible. And you know, that's quite a thing for a company or a family to choose to do, you know, as to have something meaningful that you work together. It's like, how can we raise $6,000? That was the amount, right? $6,000?
Right, exactly. Well, yeah.
How can we raise $6,000 as a team? You know, let's have a team effort. Let's do this, and let's get a well done, and let's have that as, you know, kind of something we do together for meaning as an organization, as a family, as a group, whatever it might be. I can see how that'd be cool.
You know, and a couple of things with that is that of that $6,000, 100% goes to the well. We have we have a fundraising campaign that's restricted funds. It only goes to wells. And then we have a campaign that underwrites the operating expenses. So 100% of your donation goes to the well. And there's a plaque put at the bottom of it that has your name on it. And it's very cool.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. That's great. Well, super. So I want to thank you for joining us, Charlie. It's been great to have you on the show. And any final comments you got for any leaders here who are listening in or watching?
Boy, I'll tell you, the only thing that I would say for leaders, and I've already talked about it, and that is how you treat your employees. It's remember, you are one of the most, like it or not, you're one of the most significant people in their lives. That you have the power to have them have a good day or a terrible day. You have that kind of influence. And you think we're talking humans. And you know, I just can't emphasize enough for leaders to care about their employees. And you'll make more money doing it.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to end. So thank you very much, Charlie, and thanks to our audience for being with us. And this is No Bad Bosses. And Charlie, I look forward to when our paths cross again. Thanks.
Thanks again.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. I really enjoyed talking with Charlie today. It was a little different to talk with somebody who's retired, but of course, you can't stay retired. You don't know what to do with yourself. So he came back and is working for Wells of Life and making a big impact. We're going to be back on June 5th with yet another guest. I'm sure you're going to enjoy that. So don't miss it. I'll see you then.